Welcome to this podcast from Centre for Cities, which looks at lessons from the United States on mayors. In the first part, I speak to Dr. Benjamin Barber, distinguished political theorist and author of If Mayors Ruled the World. This weekend, Benjamin's convening the first global parliament of mayors in The Hague, which will bring city mayors together to discuss global challenges. In our conversation, he touches on why cities are ideally placed to tackle international issues, like inequality and climate change, and also draws on his experience of American politics to reflect on what mayors will mean for the UK. In the second part, I'll speak to George Alorza, Mayor of Providence in Rhode Island, to get some practical advice about the powers and responsibilities of his office and what he is doing to reinvent his city's economy. But first, let's hear from Dr. Barber on why mayors should rule the world. Welcome to this podcast with Dr. Benjamin Barber. Today I'm going to be talking to Dr. Barber about how the new city region mayors that England is getting in at least seven, if not more, areas might change the way decisions get made at local and national level and what it might mean for citizens. Benjamin, one of the things that we were talking about a little earlier was a changing context for all of this. I'd be interested in your thoughts on what's the context in which these new mayors are going to be starting their new jobs.
Well, it's interesting because there's a British context and a European context, but also a global context. And let's just say a word about each. We know the British context is that of a very strong unitary state, top down, where cities have had little jurisdictional authority. They sometimes have some responsibilities, but rarely do they get the jurisdictional authority or the resources to do what they need to do. That's beginning to change. George Osborne's notion of devolution bill, which seems to be a semi-serious idea. We'll see just how serious, but there seems to be a real move in that direction, and encouragement also by the national government to have mayors elected, because many outsiders, Americans, don't realize that most British city governors and rulers and so on are not elected mayors.
Absolutely.
So that's a very important and innovative and important change that will strengthen democracy, because once mayors are elected, they will have their constituencies behind them, and the claims they make for more authority, more resources, then resonate with that democratic system. So that's number one. Number two is the European context, and of course we're talking right now in the rather sad context of Brexit. But for me, it's a much simpler thing, and it speaks to the importance of cities right now. There's a simple fact out there. The fact is we live in an interdependent world. There's no going back to a sovereign Britain, let alone an insular London or insular Bristol or insular Manchester. They are all part of a much larger world, connected by refugees, by a global economy, by global technology, by global disease, by global drugs. In fact, we live in a world where almost every major challenge is global and interdependent, and the notion of nation states, let alone city walls, are simply irrelevant. Yeah. And so the great thing about this new devolution is that, in fact, cities tend to understand the global interdependent world better than nation states, because they don't have borders, they don't have frontiers, they don't have armies and navies, they don't integrate, they don't relate to other entities, other cities, and so on through war, but through trade, through cultural exchange, through business, through transportation and travel. And in that sense, cities are plugged into the global world in ways that nation states are not. And that's a really important part of devolution, because oddly, as you devolve down to cities, you are simultaneously creating a Britain more integrated in the world. Whatever happens with Brexit, the fact is that cities being more important will make Britain more part of the world, whatever they decide to do with respect to European membership, because cities are going to be plugged in, not just to other European cities, but plugged in to global cities. So those are the sort of larger context. Finally, the other context is it's not just governance that is in crisis right now, it's democracy.
Yeah.
And we know all over the world, increasingly young people, single women raising babies, immigrants, people of color, increasingly don't believe that democracy means them. They don't think it's about them. They don't think it's their government. And that cynicism about the right to vote and the right to participate that has been the bedrock of our civilization going all the way back in so many revolutions, that's very dangerous. When people who have democracy give up on it,
yes,
and say it's not for us, it doesn't work, we can't afford that. And the great thing about cities is they are the place where democracy works, at least, let's say, better.
Yes.
Because there's more engagement, more participation, more identification. Sure, there are plenty of problems. There are corrupt mayors. There's sometimes low turnouts and so on. Although the low turnouts for mayor votes often because citizens have many other ways to participate. In national elections, the vote is all you have.
Yes.
So you bloody well better use it. But at the local level, you know, you can be on the district council, you can be on a local block association, you can be engaged in participatory zoning or participatory budgeting and so forth, and in many different ways citizens have of being part of the life of the city. That's why that word cité and citoyen, you know, has the same etymology, burg and burger in Germany.
Absolutely.
Same way that, you know, we're talking about citizenship in its most fundamental way.
So, I mean, this is we've got a metro mayor in London. We've got some city mayors, places like Leicester, but we don't have so many metro mayors. I think it's going to require a new way of doing things, both at the local level, as you said, but also at the national level. And I'd like to talk a bit about both. I mean, starting with the national level, and you'd expect me to, in a centralised country, be thinking, well, what does this mean for Whitehall? How should national government be thinking slightly differently about its relationship with cities? And is that something national government rethinks on its own, or do cities have a role in that too?
That's such a good question, Alex, and it goes to the heart of the issue, because what's at stake here is not specific administrative choices or budgeting choices, it's an attitude. It's an affect. In a centralized, unitary government with a hierarchical system, where cities have been seen as administrative units of the higher jurisdiction, there is a natural tendency to have a mindset about we, the government, the national government, and them. The representatives of the national government quite naturally said, well, we are working on this, and we hope to be able to do more for cities. You know, and actually we in the United States has it right. It's we the people. It's not we the government. It's not we the sovereignty comes from the bottom up, not from the top down, even in a constitutional monarchy.
Yes.
So not just in a republic. The mindset has to change. Central government, Whitehall, has to be thinking about what does it mean to share power and authority and resources with levels of government, with cities that are equally functional, equally important, and in some ways capable of solving problems we can no longer solve.
Yes.
And that's not a matter of what do we give them and what do we retain.
Yeah.
It's a reciprocal attitude. Let's sit together and figure out who does what best and whose resources can be best put into this. And that's a mindset, a paradigm change. And I'm waiting to see that. See, otherwise it was, I mentioned here, the big society approach of a couple of years ago. You know, everyone sort of, oh, well, the conservatives have this discovered civil society. No, they discovered an easy way to shove off a lot of responsibilities to a vague abstraction without actually empowering anybody to do anything or providing resources to do anything. And devolution, we don't want devolution to go in that same direction, to become the new big society, the new kind of excuse for saying, let cities do some more things, but God forbid they have the resources, the jurisdictional competence, or the autonomy to actually get it done. So that's the mindset.
Yes.
It's not giving power to cities. It's not giving democracy to cities. Democracy starts in the cities.
Yes.
Cities have power. It has to be recognized and given the resources to enable it to work. But it's not, power and resources are not the government's to give. They're the government's to say, we raise them together and we need to share them and work together. So I think the biggest change, and it's exciting, the devolution movement could be exciting.
Yes.
If it doesn't simply become an excuse. But for that to happen, this mindset change. As I say, I would love to see the government say, we, by which I mean we the people, which isn't us, and then go ahead and do that. That would be a mindset change. Brussels does the same thing in Europe. It talks about we. You know, we the commissioners, we the parliamentarians, the MPs of the European Parliament think that we can help the cities or give this to the cities and give. And it's the other ways around. The MPs are chosen in the cities. The resources come from the cities.
So, I mean, part of this is also about the people, isn't it, who get chosen to be the mayor. So this is a new role in the UK. You don't have many people. But one of the things that you write about in your book is the kind of people who become mayors and what makes for successful mayors and the way in which they're shaped by being a mayor of a city. Have you got any, you know, for people thinking about running?
One is that one of the virtues of a system that hasn't had elected mayors and is getting them is that I think it tends to attract not tired bureaucrats, But people like our friend, the mayor of Leicester, said, I wanted a real job. I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to do something. And he jokingly said, you know, in Parliament, in the front bench, I couldn't do much of anything. But so the good thing is that first round attracts people. I mean, George Ferguson in Bristol, that was one of the first mayors elected. And then his successor, Marvin Rees. In both cases, you have really interesting guys who are quite vital and, you know, not just your average pole, your average politician. So one thing is, newly elected mayoralties will attract people who, you know, and even in London, which is, you know, you had Ken Livingstone and then you had Boris Johnson, and both of them have gone into trouble once they moved on.
Yes.
But both of them as mayor from the opposite parties shared more in common in some ways in their dynamism and their capacity to embody London, and that was great. That's what mayors can do. But here's the second point. This is really important. Because while it is true certain kinds of people become mayors, being a mayor turns you into a certain kind of person. It works the other way too. Being mayor conditions how you are and how you behave. And it, for example, it's not just Britain, but Holland and France, where mayors are not directly elected. In Holland, they're, you know, chosen as part of a complicated system from the government above, and in France, they're part of a political party system where mayors are in effect for a while as part of, you know, there's a vote, but not directly. And, you know, they're there as part of their going up the ladder, climbing the party ladder. But what's interesting is, and even in China, where they're appointed by the Communist Party, once they are in office, the conditions of running a city, making things work, dealing with citizens, being a neighbor, conditions and influences how you are, how you operate, and what you are. So that even someone who might not be as naturally suited and dynamic as the mayor of Leicester or the mayor of London will find after they are in the post for a while, particularly when they're elected and have a responsibility and a relationship to their constituents, will find they are turning into the kind of people who I say in my book mayors are. Pragmatic, engaged, I call them homeboys, you know, they're from the home neighborhood, they're part of the, you know, they're neighbors. That's, I mean, nobody would ever call the Prime Minister a neighbor of the British people.
No.
But, you know, but we would certainly think of, you know, a guy biking, Boris biking across the Thames on his way to work, even though he's American-born, he's a Tory, and so on. Many, many people said, yeah, but he sort of felt like, you know, he really was a Londoner, and he was a neighbor. So that sense will, it means that when you become mayor, even if you don't have some of the qualities we hope you do, and that many do have, you're likely to get them because you will be shaped by the job.
And so just thinking about things they do, so Centre for Cities, we're very interested in how you support local economic growth. What is it that mayors can do? And again, you talk about this a bit in the book. What are the things that mayors can do to help the jobs, the growth in their particular place?
Well, that's a good question because it makes a nice contrast to what national politicians do. If you're a national politician, you're going to be a Republican or a Democrat, you're going to be a Labour or a Tory, you're going to be a Christian Democrat or a socialist in France or Germany. And if you're a Republican or a Tory, Christian Democrat, you're saying, well, you want to create jobs, let's have a market economy in a small state, and then you get a whole bunch of ideological quarrels. If you're the mayor of a city, you can't say, let's have a market economy and the hell with the unions, I'm down with you. A conservative Republican like Bloomberg knew once he was mayor of New York, he had to deal with the police union, the fire union, the teachers union, the hospital unions. The unions are crucial. Public unions in most cities are absolutely crucial. I don't care how much of a Milton Friedman market guy you are, you got to deal with the unions. And on the other hand, you're Bill de Blasio, a good progressive Democrat who just became mayor of New York last year. And he came in thinking, to hell with the real estate lobby and to hell with Wall Street and so on. Doesn't work that way. And de Blasio has discovered that while he wants affordable housing, the only way to get affordable housing is to work with the developers, not to throw them out. But you need consensus. You don't have enough power as a mayor to do it without it. So public-private partnerships, which is everybody's favorite mantra, actually work in cities because mayors have to reach out to big. I mean, if a big firm says, you know what, screw you, I'm getting out. Whoa, we can't afford for you to get out, even though you're partly the source of inequality. You know, but let's find ways to make you part of the equality equation, not, you know, get the hell out. And if you're a conservative and you union, say, well, yeah, but we need your workers and we need the. So mayors can't afford the kind of ideological hair splitting that you do. They need public-private partnerships. They need civil society. They need culture and the foundations. They need everybody to make it work. And good mayors, it turns out, tend to be favored by both business and by unions, by both workers and by the business folks. And that's why the successful ones, whether it's Fiorello LaGuardia in New York or Bloomberg in New York, do that. And the ones who don't do that, like Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, they get in trouble because they think it's an ideological job. And my job is to make the union small or eliminate the public unions, which the governor of Wisconsin was trying to do. You can't operate that way. Yeah. Cities work by consensus. It's always a three-legged stool: government, civil society, and business. And you need all three. You can't make a city work without them. So there is a mandate for pragmatism that sort of says, you know, I don't care whether you're Labour or Tory.
Yeah.
You got to make it work. In that sense of making things work, whether it's, you know, I tell the story in this book about Teddy Kollek, who was the mayor of Jerusalem in the 1980s. And then, as now, he would be besieged every week by imams and Christian prelates and rabbis arguing about their historical narratives and their right to the holy sites. And they give him lectures and sermons and yell at him. And he tells the story. So one day he turns and says, gentlemen, spare me your sermons, and I will fix your sewers. And that's a great, you know, that's sort of what mayors do. Spare me the capitalist socialist debates, and, you know, I'm going to try to make the subways run. I'm going to try to get the garbage picked up. I'm going to try to make this city work.
Yeah.
And real government is about making things work so we can live our private lives and enjoy liberty and have economic prosperity and have fairness and have equality. And mayors get that.
Yeah.
And so they don't always do it equally well, yes, but they understand that's the task, not to win a theoretical debate. Bernie Sanders was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont 25, 30 years ago. And he was a very good mayor. And you know why? He worked with real estate developers. He worked with bankers and so on. Running for president's break up the banks, slow down things, you know, and that was fine, and that attracted a lot of kids, and free education for all. He never said as Burlington mayor, free education for all, because he knew that would mean not paying teachers anything, and you'd drive all the good teachers out. He was much more nuanced because he had to make it work. But at the national level, we can get into all this baloney, you know, about, you know, abstract ideals, and we all love them. Free education for all, break up the banks, great. Sure. But when you're running a city, you got to make things work. You need to deal with the folks who are there, whether it's refugees there illegally, who you're going to help get urban visas for so that they can go to school and use the hospitals, their kids can get educated and they can get jobs because they're there. It's not your job to deport them. They're there.
Yes.
That's what mayors do. That kind of pragmatism is what mayors do, and that's what makes cities work. I mean, Washington, twice in the last 2 years, has closed its doors. No government.
Yes. Yeah.
First thing, nobody noticed. But the second thing, but imagine, you can't close cities. Imagine closing Leicester, closing Lyon, closing New Orleans. You can't close a city.
So
no police, no fire, no hospitals. No, you can't do it.
They have to make things
work. They have to make it work.
I think that's a great note to end on. Dr. Benjamin Barber, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex, very much. Great to be with you.
The emphasis Benjamin placed on pragmatism is echoed by George Alorza, Mayor of Providence in Rhode Island. Here he is on the challenges facing his city and his advice for mayors in the UK.
Providence is a post-industrial city. It was a centre for manufacturing for about a century. But then unfortunately, as the global economy changed, we lost a lot of these jobs. First, we lost them from the city to our suburbs, and then we lost them from our cities to other countries. And so, as a city, Providence has been trying to remake itself, reinvent itself. What are we about? What do we do? And that's what we're in the middle of right now. You know, thankfully, and we're very excited about this. And we have a lot to build off of. You know, when you look at cities that are thriving throughout the world, there are cities that, you know, attract this new breed of individual. People want to live close to the city center. That's different from the way it's always been in the United States. And when you look at, you know, the amenities that they're searching for, you know, they want quality of life, they want arts and culture, they want walkable cities, they want a vibrant city that they can feel proud of being a part of. And we have that. In fact, we have that in spades in Providence. We have a very vibrant arts and culture scene. We have beautiful architecture. We have great quality of life. We have wonderful universities. And we have great diversity and great neighborhoods, not to mention great food as well. So we have so many of these qualities that people are looking for nowadays. It's just a matter of bringing it all together and building off of very specific strategic strengths that we have as a city. Because, you know, you can't come in with a shotgun approach. Sure. It has to be very directed and very targeted. And, we're selecting very distinct focus areas that we're going to build off of. So, you know, some focus areas that stand out, for example, the food industry. We have wonderful restaurants. But beyond that, we also have a wonderful university that's one of the culinary leaders in the world, located right in the heart of our city. We also have great research institutions that are doing phenomenal work around nutrition and using and thinking of food as medicine. So we have a strategic strength around food, sure. And we want to develop that and brand the city in that way. So what we're doing is looking at what our strengths are, focusing on them very, very precisely, and then branding ourselves in that way so that we can attract economic investment and attention.
One of the big challenges in a post-industrial city is bringing citizens with you in the UK. So when you look at the cities that have been built on steel or some of the kind of big industries, there's a real attachment and sense of identity that goes with that. How are you bringing citizens with you on this shift towards making the most of different strengths in Providence?
So Providence is indeed a post-industrial city, but you know the world changes so fast nowadays, and people understand that there has to be a change. We've struggled since the recession of 2008. We haven't yet recovered all of the jobs that we lost, and so people understand that we need change, and people are really hungry and thirsty for that change. So what's very important for me as a city mayor is that we turn our economy around and start creating more jobs in the new economy. But just as importantly, it's the case that you know we have to make sure that the economic prosperity that we usher in, that it be accessible to all of our residents. So that's of primary importance to me as a city leader. We see great divisions in terms of wealth and inequality in our city, and for you to be a leading 21st century city, there has to be a unifying theme, a unifying sense of identity that brings a city together. And you can't have that when there are great disparities in income and wealth. You can't have one city doing well and another side of the city doing very poorly. So a big challenge for me is making sure that as we build this new economy and build off of all of these strategic strengths that are bringing new and young people to our city, we can't forget about our roots, who we are at our core. And, that means that we have to find, we have to meet people where they are. And so I'm investing a great deal in our education system, making sure that, we have the resources in place to support the people in the front lines, and that we're also skilling up our workforce so that, folks who in a generation ago would have been part of the manufacturing industry, now they have the skills to not only compete but also thrive in this new economy that we're building. So, that entails a lot of different things. It means making sure that we're aligning our workforce development resources with our education system, but also engaging our business community. Call it enlightened self-interest or something else, but the business community is recognizing more and more that their futures are tied to the quality of our workforce.
Yeah.
And I've been building up relationships and meeting with business leaders specifically, and I've been so heartened by how eager they've been to partner with city leaders. And I think that, coming back to a conversation about the role of mayors in the United States, that's one thing that can't be overestimated. Having the principal political figure reaching out directly to business leaders and asking them to be part of a broader initiative and broader movement to help the community is extremely powerful. And I try to exercise my voice in that way as much as possible.
I mean, that was one of my next questions. In the UK, we're starting to introduce more mayors, but there's a lot of debate still about whether you need one or not, what role they might have. And talking to you about the different roles you have as mayor. I'd be really interested in your reflections about how having a mayor is distinct from what we have here, which is leaders of cabinets or people slightly more removed. Having a mayor with a mandate mm-hmm. can make a difference, not just to talking to the community, but business as well, as you were just saying.
I chuckle a little bit as I learn about municipal governments in other countries. I can't think of how a city would function without a mayor.
Yes.
The kind of issues that I face on a daily basis. So I might be meeting with business leaders in the morning and talking about economic development. In the afternoon, I might be talking about education policy and how to get more of our kids, on the college path. But at the end of the day, the role of mayor is it's very retail. It's very connected to the communities. So, for example, if someone passes away in the city, I'm there with the family, or I go to the wake, or I see how we can help. You know, I've had instances where someone is getting a divorce from their husband, and they think of perhaps someone in the mayor's office can call me. And so the relationship that people have with their mayor is a very personal and a very special one.
Yes.
It's part of what makes this job so great, that we can talk about big and long-term policy issues, but at the end of the day, this is a very relationship-oriented job. And I have those relationships with people just as much as I have them with institutions. And it's that connection that, puts you in a position where you can actually, connect dots that other people wouldn't see, so you can be more effective in your role.
I think that point about relationships and powers is a really important one. So we've always, when we've written about mayors at the Centre for Cities, talked about a need for powers, clearly, specific powers, and it'd be great to hear what you have got power over, but also that need for the way that the role creates an ability to forge relationships that you wouldn't mm-hmm. have, and they aren't specific powers, they're just relationships. I mean, interested in what powers you have, whether you think, it sounds like you don't, it's not just limited to those powers, actually it's about the relationships beyond them.
Right, and so in the United States, the state, so we have a federal system, but it's the states that are the actual, legal corporate or corporal entities. And then they delegate powers to the municipalities, and usually the local issues that are delegated down to the municipality are issues such as education, so running all of our public schools, issues such as public safety, police, fire and emergency management, things such as that, and also the property and real estate system. Most municipalities in the United States are funded primarily through real estate taxes. So that's, that runs almost, that runs the gambit. And in all of these areas, where you send your children to school, what kind of roads you drive on, what kind of opportunities are available to you, they touch people at a very personal level. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm thinking through my priorities and my job, it's very people-centered and based on those relationships that I hear from every day. So, for example, being out in the community, being out in the neighborhood and hearing people struggling about the lack of economic opportunity, the lack of jobs, construction jobs, for example, that have been hit very hard by the recession in our city. I recently launched an initiative to help eliminate all of the abandoned properties that we have in our city.
Oh, wow.
Currently, we have 500 to 600 abandoned properties that have been sitting there for a good 7-8 years. Mm. So too much time has passed. And we designed this program so that we can fix all of these properties, and we can do it in a way so that the people that are fixing them is not some large corporate construction firm, but instead it's small contractors in our neighborhoods. And the reason why we've designed it this way is because talking to people directly and hearing so many of the concerns and challenges that they face, I see that this has to be a priority.
Sure.
And so, that's what's really neat about this job. Or hearing directly from parents, they tell you that they go to the central administrative offices and they don't feel as though they're receiving the level of attention and services that they feel they're entitled to. While there are things that we can do with this. We're looking at transforming the way that our central administration functions and decentralizing influence and resources from that central office and out into the schools so they can be more responsive.
So from the mayor's office, from that kind of municipality to a lower level. So it's not just about your powers, it's about pushing it out.
Exactly. Being closer to the people. And, you know, these are different initiatives that we have in City Hall. But the point is that the reason why these have become priorities in my administration is because I have these relationships with folks from the community. This is what I hear directly from them. And so it shapes, you know, what I believe is most necessary in our city. And I'm able to implement that in a way that is, you know, particularly responsive to the concerns that I hear on a daily basis.
Which is really powerful because here, even when mayors are set up, some of those decisions will still be out of their hands, for example, around schools. So I think it's really interesting to hear what you can do. I mean, one of the other points you've been making is about that engagement with citizens. And a big challenge here is around the democratic accountability of mayors, not just because they are happening without people being asked, but also because there are concerns both about how much people will vote for them, but also how they'll be held to account. I mean, do you have any reflections from the work that you do about how you can make sure a mayor is really engaging with citizens and being held to account by them and others?
Sure. You know, I think that we have to start off appreciating the fact that the way that people see their mayor and the kind of relationship that people want to have with their mayor is a very personal one. And so if you're not out in the community, you're not visible and you're not seen, then that's certainly going to work against you. You might have the best policies, but you really have to have that personal contact with residents. So, I've started this series of monthly and bi-monthly community meetings where I go out to different community groups throughout the city, and we just have a conversation. I talk about what my priorities are in City Hall, and then I, spend about an hour and a half, 2 hours, listening to members of the public, tell me what's on their mind, and I have my entire administration there, all of my directors. We're taking down information, we're responding to any concerns that they raise, and we're letting them know that we want you to come to us. In fact, you don't even have to come to us; we will come to you, but we are there to serve. So we have to start off understanding that relationship between the mayor and the community is very important. And then, every politician has to have in mind, is this going to be helpful or unhelpful going into the re-election? But as an elected official, you weren't elected to think about yourself in the next election. Yeah. You were elected to provide a vision and provide leadership for what you believe is in the best interest of the city over the long term. And so as a mayor and as any political leader, you have to be bold, you have to be brave, and you have to provide that leadership. And so that democratic accountability will always be there. But at the end of the day, I truly believe that democracy is fair. If you do a fine job, you'll be rewarded and reelected. If you do a poor job, you'll be punished and you'll be voted out of office. And so, of course you have to keep in mind, when your next election is coming up. But if you're letting that guide your priorities as a mayor, you're going to be unsuccessful and you're going to be voted out of office.
And I think your experiences clearly have a lot of lessons for the people who are thinking about being mayors here, running for mayor, when we're thinking about setting things up. And these are enormously live discussions that we're having, every day at the moment, about what does it look like and what does it mean. From your experience, if you were talking to the people first, the people setting up this institution of mayor, what would be the three things you would say to them when they're setting up the institution? And I'll come on to the people doing the job, but what would you say from your experience, you need to make sure you do this when you set up this role of mayor?
So it's a little bit different because it's my perspective on this is based on the American model.
Of course.
But a conversation that an ongoing conversation that we have in the United States around mayors is, should mayors control the schools or not, public education? And we're very fortunate in Providence that the mayor, it's a strong mayoral form that also appoints the school board, and the school board names and hires the superintendent who runs the entire school. So You know, the conversation of how much authority and responsibility should be given to the mayors, I think that having a strong executive and someone who is able to galvanize support, provide that leadership, makes all the difference because, you know, what mayors do is mayors act. I don't have time to have philosophical or ideological conversations about, you know, leftist and rightist and doctrine. It's about what do people need, what do people need now, and having a competent administration that is able to produce results for all of the constituents. And you know, when you have that kind of leader within an organization, I think that you want to empower them so that they can be much more effective. So certainly with our schools, that's one of our greatest challenges in our city. If you're going to get blamed for the state of your schools, you should have the authority to do something about it. You know, the second thing that comes to mind in terms of creating the institution of mayor is, I know that some municipalities here in Europe, they have the mayor's administration is made up of other elected officials. So the mayor has to form a coalition government from other elected officials. My suggestion would be that you give the mayor the ability, the power to build up their own team, sure, so that he and she can surround him or herself by, you know, the people that work best with her leadership style, his leadership style, and is able to realize his or her vision. So I think that that's another sort of institutional point about it. And then the last piece, and this is something that's perhaps a little bit more it's an emerging topic in the United States, if not more controversial. It's flexibility in the ability to raise revenue.
Yes.
In the United States, municipalities are funded almost entirely through real estate taxes,
yeah,
which is a very inefficient way of doing it.
Why do you say that? I ask because this is a live topic here.
Yeah, so, you know, I believe, you know, progressive taxation system is preferable, and we have that in terms of taxing income at the federal level and also at the state level. But the challenge is that, you know, when times are tough, are the times when municipalities and residents need the greatest amount of resources, but that's when you have the fewest resources at your disposal.
Sure.
And so having a system in place so that you can have more stabilities that hedges for, you know, boom times and down times would be much more helpful. But at the same time, you know, we have a system that's been in place for the past 200 years. We've relied on real estate taxes, and so we've made do over time. This question of, you know, the ability of municipal leaders to raise revenue and how they diversify those revenue streams is definitely one to consider very carefully.
Wonderful. And last question for me, for anyone considering running as mayor, any advice?
Well, sure, a lot of advice. You know, I do believe that you have to maintain that connection to the people. That's really fundamental. That's the most important thing. Make sure that you're in tune and in touch with what's happening at the ground level, at the street and neighborhood level. And as you maintain that connection, make sure that you surround yourself by people who will provide different perspectives. I think that a mistake that I've seen many mayors make is that you close yourself off to the people that you listen to, and you're not hearing from the entire community. So, you know, we have to make a particular effort to make sure that we're out there and hearing from as many different constituents as possible. And if we can't hear from them directly, we have to surround ourselves by people who do, by people who can give us that perspective. And you know, as a mayor, you have to be bold. We're not going to transform our cities if we have this mentality of slightly moving the needle. You know, we have to be bold in what we do. We have to be good communicators and let people know exactly why we're doing it. We have to build broad coalitions, you know, find out what it is that we have in common, where our interests converge, and how we can rally around a specific initiative or an issue. And you know, we have to have a compassionate mind and heart, and remember that the reason why we're doing this is not for political gain or for personal gain. It's because we want to make a difference in the lives of people. And there's so many people throughout our cities that rely on what we do on a daily basis. And so if you take that responsibility to heart, you truly focus on what your community needs, and you're intelligent about bringing a broader coalition of people along with you, I think that you're setting yourself up to be a very successful mayor. And if you allow yourself to be bold and have a grand vision for your city, it's amazing how much of an impact you can have and how many people's lives you can touch in a very positive way.